Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of Episode 10 in the series. Nonviolent Direct Action is pleased to have the opportunity to speak to a woman who has stood tall in opposition to the use, in the preparation to use, the ultimate in weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons. Sister Megan Rice does not stand tall in size. I think she's about 5 foot tall, maybe 100 pounds. But no woman in international nuclear resistance stands taller. Now, that's a pretty big statement to make. But let me just read it as an introduction what the New York Times wrote in August of 2012. It's a very long article, and it's entitled "The Nun Who Broke Into the Nuclear Sanctum" by William Broad of the New York Times. But I'm just going to read a brief segment, but I think it's well done. He says, Sister Megan Rice, 82. That was back in 2012. So I think, Sister, you're going to be 89 within another couple of months. A Roman Catholic nun of the Society of the Holy Child Jesus and two male accomplices have carried out what nuclear experts call the biggest security breach in the history of the nation's atomic complex, making their way to the inner sanctum of the site where the United States keeps crucial bomb parts and fuel. And then in quotation points, deadly force is authorized, sign there reads, again in quotation points, halt, images of skulls emphasize the lethal danger. With flashlight and bolt cutters, the three defied barbed wire as well as armed guards, video cameras, and motion sensors at the Oak Ridge Nuclear Reservation in Tennessee early in July 28th, a Saturday. Again, this is of 2012. They splashed blood on the highly enriched uranium materials facility, a new windowless half-billion-dollar plant encircled by enormous guard towers, and hung banners outside its walls. Now, we could jump right into all of that, Megan, and that's going to be the crux of your story here, the most recent, and as they have said over and over in all the mass media, all you have to do is go into Google, type in Megan Rice, and you'll get NBC and the British Economist, Washington Post, which, by the way, the Washington Post, I think did one of the longest pieces ever on a situation like this, six pages, including illustrations. All of that is there for anybody who really wants to check further on Megan Rice. But what I would like to do is to sort of backpedal a bit, and would like to hear about your early life, growing up in Manhattan. You were born in Manhattan, and that was back in 1930. Can you tell us something about your early childhood and maybe something about your mom and dad?
Yes, I would be very happy to. Is it okay at this point to mention the other two colleagues?
Go right ahead.
To give us their names. I think it's very important that because they're totally equally, we are all involved in this. And it's Michael Wally, who is a member of the Catholic Worker in Washington, D.C., Dorothy Day Catholic Worker, and Greg Borgi-Obed, who works in a variety of peace action goals in Duluth. So I just need to honor the two of them.
We'll get back to Michael and Greg later on when we get into the nitty-gritty of that whole action. But back to your childhood.
Yes, I was born in Manhattan on East 86th Street in 1930, January 31st, 1930. And we lived there until I was 17, and they continued to make New York their home. So,
what did they do for a living, your mom and dad?
Well, my father was an obstetrician and taught at NYU Medical School for about 27 years, as well as a small practice. But mainly he was teaching medical students obstetrics. And my mother after she studied while we were growing up and got her master's in history at Columbia University and then her doctorate in history with the focus on the American Catholic opinion on the slavery controversy, which was her research at Columbia University in 1944.
Is that paper, by the way, available? That sounds like an interesting...
It's definitely online as the title, The American Catholic Opinion on the Slavery Controversy by Madeline Rice, R-I-C-E.
Okay. Now, the thing that I wanted to ask you about is what sort of influence did your mother and father have on you as a young girl? What comes to mind, at least, as some sort of strong views, et cetera, that you may have had? Or maybe you didn't have strong views at that time.
I did have strong views, and it was a social conscience. They definitely were people who spoke about the problems that were the wants of the age in the 40s, when we were having dinner at night, we would be focused on what was happening in the world.
These were during the war, the war years for Americans,
that's right.
1941 to 45. Let's jump to a really big question. In August of 1945, the United States incinerated pretty much the city of Hiroshima, and then just 3 days later, Nagasaki. At that time, you were 15 years old, and apparently war studied, and with all of those discussions and all, where was your thinking in August of 1945 when you saw some of the results of the destruction of those two cities?
We didn't hear of the destruction at all. I can remember the day on the 6th August, 1945. My sister and I, my Maddie and I, were at camp in Maine near Portland. And my mother called us on that very day, elated because her brother, our uncle, would then not have to be part of the invasion of Japan because this wonderful bomb had been dropped, and she was very excited about it.
Was that sort of a general feeling from your remembrance of other kids in camp and adults, etc.? What was the general attitude? You're expressing your mother said this, but what about other people? It's pretty much the same?
Yes, we were of the age of 15. Many had brothers who were at war. We were all elated that the war had ended, at least the war in Japan. The war in Europe had already ended, I think, wasn't it?
Right.
April or so.
Right. Yeah. You know, you could go into a length about, you know, what was the rationale for dropping the bomb, and usually they'll say that because to prevent an invasion, which has been, by the way, historically refuted over and over again, but it's impacted on the American mind, and so it's going to be very hard to get away from that other than scholarly studies. But let's go on from this a little bit now. You were in high school at this time, and so you're 15 years old. Where did you go to high school?
I went to one that was run by our sisters called Holy Child Academy on 140th Street and Riverside Drive, a small school, about 120 students.
And so within a period of a few years, you made a decision that you were going to go into a religious order. Tell us about how that came about.
It came about because of my interest in Africa and the way I had been educated by my mother about the terrible things that the American had done to African Americans, bringing them over from Africa against their will and enslaving them. And that was a very large part of growing up. And we talked about it in school when we were in the sixth and seventh grade. We tried to let other people have that awareness.
So was this sort of a sense that you would be maybe eventually give back to the African people by going to Africa?
Exactly. I felt responsible to be part of that. And I always wanted in some way to be able to make up. And I didn't consider myself somebody who would be a teacher. I just sort of didn't think I had that gift of being a teacher. But the sisters that taught us had started schools for girls in Nigeria and Ghana, starting in 1930, actually, when I was born. But by then, we had schools established in 1945, and I was very aware of that. We were trying to raise money, you know, for the people there and so forth.
You still had to get a bachelor's degree, and eventually you got a master's degree. And I'm kind of curious about how you would bring, was it radiation biology? Why that particular emphasis if you're going off to Africa?
Well, it just happened serendipitously, we might say. When I was living and teaching in Melrose, Massachusetts, they knew that I could not be accepted or recognized as a graduate teacher, therefore getting a salary from the government in Nigeria to help run our schools there. So I had to get a master's degree that would be acceptable. So they said, what will it be, biology, chemistry, or physics? Because that was what was needed in our schools at that time. They had very few Africans who were teaching those subjects. So I said, well, I've always loved biology. So then they sent, well, you go to Boston College. So I had to apply to get in the biology department at Boston College. And the priest there, who was head of the department, was doing a project for the U.S. Army Air Force, I believe it was, on the use of radioactive tracer compounds, how you use radioactivity to trace life processes in organisms.
This will play a big part in your decisions later on dealing with radioactivity.
Yeah, exactly. And because I had to learn and understand tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, and we used compounds that had radioactive emitting beta particles. I had to learn how to wear a lead apron and prevent the radiation from affecting me. So I was the first person at Boston College to be given a project that used radioactive isotopes. And it was more to learn the technique, actually. The department wanted to know because they hadn't ever used them in their own studies. It was very new in the late 50s.
Was there a carryover of that education when you went? Did you go to Ghana or Nigeria first?
First, I was in Nigeria.
Nigeria. Was there any carryover to these studies, or were you into something else?
Well, I certainly felt that I was teaching science. So it taught me about elements. And when I was teaching chemistry, for instance, also part of my biology, but especially in the chemistry, I would start with the elements. Some of them are radioactive, some of them are not, and some of them have radioactive, as we say, isotopes. In other words, I used it in order to help them to understand chemistry.
What are your fondest memories of Africa?
It was the openness and the eagerness and the ambition of Nigerian students to learn, and their gratitude to be in high school, because we were the ones that were starting the high schools. There had been primary schools, as I say, since 1930 for girls and boys. But then we began some of the primary schools. We turned into teacher training colleges. So we were training teachers, our sisters, as well, who would man then, or woman, or the primary schools. They would be the people to open new primary schools. And then we needed secondary schools. So some of our teacher training colleges, we probably had 10 or 15 of them in the end, were turned into secondary schools. They're people who are extremely hospitable. Hospitality is the thing, and will go to no length to make you feel at home. And you must have a meal when you visit somebody. It's that complete openness. I found this in Palestine myself also, when you had to knock on the door of somebody, they just completely welcome you. And is there anything they can do to help you? I would say very similar to the hospitality that I experienced when I did 9-month sabbatical in Palestine.
You're listening to episode 10 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is Sister Megan Rice. There was a war going on while you were there. Could you sort of briefly tell us what that was all about, and were you involved in any activities there?
In 67, we knew that a war was looming, a civil war in that area called the Biafran War. And we were there for the whole of the start of that and tried to prepare our students for independence. I can remember joking about, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Explain again, Biafra now was attempting to break away from Nigeria.
That's correct. Because of the oil, it had to do really with the oil industry, definitely. The southern part of Nigeria had the oil, and the northern part didn't. And the Nigerian government did not want any breakaway because they wanted a share in the oil industry. And that went on for 3 years, from 1967 to 1970. There was a very vicious war going on in certain parts of what we call Biafra, not everywhere. It was limited by, you know, the inability to carry on a big war on both sides.
Was there a religious element to that as well as oil?
It did happen that in the south, the people were more Christian, and in the north, they were 50% Muslim. So that definitely had an element, because there was animosity, there was competition, there was ambition between the Christians and the Muslims.
What about the Africans themselves? What were their, as you reflect back, their thoughts about the United States?
They would be varied. We as Americans felt the pressure of the American, like USAID, and the greed for getting involved in the oil. We resented that. Those of us who were Americans were ashamed at the effort of the American policies to encroach upon the independence of, first of all, Biafra, and then the rest of Nigeria. But the Nigerian government and the United States government were in collusion with each other in opposition to the southern group where the oil was actually located.
So the war was eventually settled, and Biafra still just is considered to be part of Nigeria. It did not successfully...
Oh, yeah. It was completely... They surrendered, and they completely turned over, and it was just amazing to be part of the very end of the war. I can remember being in a town called Calabar, and just two of us sisters, many of our sisters went out of the country during the war, and then some came back, and I was one that did leave for a while and came back. So I was there to see the wonderful spirit of coming together right as the war ended. We had a dinner, and there were people from the Biafran side and people who were fighting against them and the Nigerian side, and they were just all joking and laughing, and it was just wonderful to see the humanity that came out at the end of that war. It was a great privilege to be able to sit and just listen to them joking about what there were times when neither side had weapons and they had to just sit and not fight on either side of a river, and they would sell cigarettes to each other. I mean, it was just very interesting to see a local civil war, how being fought by people who really weren't, their hearts were not in the battle by any means, some of them.
For whatever reason, you eventually decide to come back to the United States. Can you tell us why that occurred?
It was mostly malaria, actually, that I began getting it very frequently. And a Congolese doctor and his wife, also a doctor, advised me to just get out of the country for 6 weeks or so and allow the malaria to subside. I left for that reason. And then I began to realize that I was not needed as a teacher of science because there were so many qualified Nigerians who were also being educated at Nigerian universities, of which we had at least five.
Congratulations on being part of that. When you came back, you somehow got involved with the United States Army School of the Americas. And so we're interested to hear how you somehow gravitated toward resistance of the U.S. Army School of the Americas.
It was in 1990 when my sister, who had been primary caregiving to my mother was living with her and her husband, and she said, "Do you think you could come back for a while and be near and assist in this?" Which is what I should have been doing. So I requested from our society that my sister had asked if I'd be able to become near, and they said, "Absolutely, you do that." So first of all, in 1990, I came and I stayed in Syracuse, New York, and got working in a parish there while caring for my mother.
So working in that parish somehow led you into resistance activities?
Yes, absolutely. Right away, there were a large number of people in Syracuse who were knowing all about this United States Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia at that time. And we would go down when there would be a gathering from all over the country to try to oppose and expose the fact that the United States Army was teaching the officers of Latin American countries, especially dictatorial countries, how to torture their people. Techniques in torture were being taught at the United States Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. And how many people knew that in the country? So those of us who did know it formed this School of the Americas Watch, SOAW. That were very active in Syracuse. So I got involved and we did direct action at Fort Benning.
Explain what you mean by direct action at Fort Benning.
Okay, there was a big rally, a huge rally. First maybe it was 60 people, then the next year it was 600 people. And then the next year it was like 4,000 or 5,000 people. You know, it exponentially increased year by year in the 90s. And we decided that we would cross the line, meaning there was a certain area in the base, which was an open base, this Fort Benning, and we would walk in and keep on going in order to protest and try to express the truth and knowing that there would be arrests.
So people should know, though, Megan, if I can interrupt you for a minute, they should know that the U.S. Army School of the Americas was at Fort Benning, but it was sort of a base within the base, right? And you were going to walk
That's
in.
That's correct.
You were going to walk in to where this U.S. Army right. School of the Americas. Okay, I just want to make sure that, you know, listeners understand what this was about.
Yeah, and they would collect all the people and give them citations for having crossed over this line, an arbitrary point in the road. And in the beginning, nothing happened. And then the next year, we were called to trial in January or February. This happened in November of the year before.
Tell us about what happened in the trial.
Yes, we had the opportunity to speak out and tell the truth, and the judge had to allow the story to be told and go on the record, and we felt that that was the purpose of being arrested, so that it would get into the transcripts of court cases that this was going on, that the United States was teaching torture, and that in itself needed to be resisted. And sometimes we were sent to prison 6 months the first time. And then the next year, when we met again, some of us crossed the line a second time, first 25 of us, and the next year, 10 of us. So some of us went 1 year after another to 6 months in prison.
When you went to prison, for example, I believe it was in 2000, this was the second time you went to prison. First you went to Muskogee County Jail, and then you went to federal prison. How did that work?
Well, the Muskogee County Jail was just like, at the most, a month while we awaited trial. Then the trial was, we were sent to Danbury Prison.
Danbury, Connecticut.
Correct, yeah. And we were released at the end of the first 6 months, and then some of us went back again the next time, and the officer said, oh, you're here you are again. You just have to do what you've got to do, I guess. Anyway, it was a camp. It was not a, it's a highly secure prison.
What were the women in prison, in jail for? What were they, what was their crime?
So much of it was carrying drugs or, you know, doing it for others, or sometimes being informed upon falsely by others. I got to know several women who, one has, she's still there and we're still working on her. Two life sentences plus 50 years was hers, because she was informed upon falsely by the person who was involved and actually did a drug-related murder. And this man informed that she had done it falsely. And so she was the one who was charged with associating in a drug-related murder. And because he had informed on her, he was sent scot-free. The one who actually did the murder never went to prison. He was rewarded for telling on the, it was a group of others. She happened to be one of them.
So you were in jail, in prison. Actually, it's 1 year. You spent six months incarcerations because of activities at the U.S. Army School of the Americas, which simply meant you were, again, nonviolent, as you've always been. You walked across a line, right? That's about it. We're not talking about any major crime. Now, you go through all of this, and then you go back to Africa for several years, and then is it malaria again that more or less forces you to come back to the U.S.?
I think it was my mother. I needed to come back to be with her a second time.
Yeah, and so somewhere along the line, you find now that nuclear resistance. You've got to start acting on the worst of all possible conditions, and that is the obliteration of the whole world, and the Americans being the leading holder of, along with the Russians, of nuclear weapons. So what eventually made that transition from the U.S. Army School of the Americas, not that you gave that up, but that you found your niche now that seemed to kind of focus on resistance to nuclear weapons? Tell us how that came about.
My dominant memory of this country was growing up as a teenager when my uncle, Walter, my mother's brother, was a Marine and assigned to the occupation of Nagasaki for the next 5 months right after the Nagasaki bomb. Well, it was 5 weeks. They didn't send people in until 5 weeks for the occupation. And there was nothing to do in Nagasaki because all the people had died. And so he was given a jeep. He was a young lieutenant by this time in the Marines. And the sergeant below him said, look, there's nothing for you to do. So you just take this jeep and drive around. So he was totally free to keep on going, investigating exactly the condition of Nagasaki, and also free to meet at the port in Nagasaki a Jesuit archbishop who was from Nagasaki but had been doing public service during the war in Tokyo or somewhere. And he returned to his diocese. And my uncle drove him to the cathedral, which had been his as an archbishop, and where his mother and his sister had been at Mass on the 9th of August, 1945, and therefore experienced the bomb at 8:15 in the morning and were incinerated, his mother and his sister. And my uncle was the one to bring him there when he returned in 1945. And all of that, my uncle, you know, would tell us about what it was like. So I had an inside picture of what the United States had done to Nagasaki. So I felt it was very important to get involved in ending the transformation of the nuclear weapons industry, which was big, big profiteering.
You're listening to episode 10 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is Sister Megan Rice. The very cathedral that you're talking about, of course, was the Catholic cathedral that became ground zero, because as we remember it, the aircraft carrying the weapon that was dropped on Nagasaki was actually, I believe, going to Nagoya, but it was so cloudy over Nagoya, they couldn't do it. So they found a secondary target in the opening in the clouds was the cathedral. The Catholic cathedral is the largest Christian population in Asia, was in Nagasaki, and so the cathedral became ground zero. So that was a pretty awesome kind of thing for your uncle to be taking the bishop there to see where his mother and sister were incinerated. So anyway, that's a powerful story, Megan, and that obviously must have had an impact on you. So all of a sudden you seem to gravitate toward a group called Plowshares. Could you tell us about Plowshares and what their program is?
Yes. When our mother died in 1999, I asked if I could live at Jonah House because I had met Phil Berrigan and Liz, and I had visited there, you know. And so I joined that community after my mother died and was there for 9 months.
Now, this is Phil Berrigan, who is married to the former Catholic sister, Elizabeth McAllister. And people should know that Phil Berrigan spent approximately 10 years in federal prison focused on resistance to the United States' possible use of more nuclear weapons, right? I just wanted to make sure that, you know, people remember Phil Berrigan, who is deceased. His wife, Elizabeth McAllister, who, as we speak, is incarcerated in Georgia for a Plowshares action. So here you're with a person who really many people look upon as pretty much the father of nuclear resistance in the United States. So tell us more about that.
Yes, he was inviting me to participate in the action that they were planning, which is usually kept very kind of secret. And I was there at the whole meeting and everything. But at that point, I was being sent back to Nigeria. I was just waiting to go. So I said, I'm sorry. They're already going to be sending me back. So I couldn't accept the invitation to do an action. So naturally, when I got back to this country, and I was very aware of the evil of nuclear weapons, going back to my uncle's experience in World War II, and that nuclear weapons were still being produced, and it was a huge industry profiteering from making weapons of mass destruction. And by this time, I knew that they were against international law and many treaties, international treaties that supersede United States law.
You go through a period of years, Megan, where you're arrested. And a lot of these arrests are because of nuclear activities. I think you're out in Nevada. You're all over the place. But somewhere along the line, you decide that you're going to do something very serious. So tell us about your Transform Now Plowshares.
Yes, Greg Borgi-Obed and I had discerned, and that means we prayed together for about 2 weeks at their house in Duluth, Minnesota. And we realized that there hadn't been an action for a number of years, and there needed to be. And that both of us were at a stage where we had no big responsibilities to anybody. His wife was willing to have him engage in seeing how we could and where, if another action was needed, another what we call Plowshares action. Plowshares meaning that the first action in 1980 by Phil and Dan and six or seven others.
Phil and Dan Berrigan being the brother of Phil Berrigan.
And they saw the connection between Isaiah chapter 2, where it says, they will beat their swords into plowshares, and nations shall no longer make war again. And so that became the model for resisting nuclear weapons in various places. And different people over the years had performed plowshares actions similar in style, in some way symbolically beating against the weapon with a hammer, usually, and pouring blood to remind people that it's the result of nuclear weapons is death and incineration and the terrible effects on so many people. And the various other symbols that were used in usually each plowshares action, and there have been how many, 20 or 30 now?
Probably over 20, but in 2012, when you were beginning to discern, there had been kind of a lapse there, especially with the death of Phil Berrigan. And of course, Dan Berrigan at this stage was really quite old and beginning to get feeble. So you three decided that you had almost a moral obligation to take some sort of action. So tell us a little bit more about that. That's an intriguing story. Plowshares transform now.
We went to the various communities where nuclear weapons facilities existed. Michael and I visited from one to the other and consulted them. And all of them are places where there was a good community in resistance. Until we got to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and spoke with the community that surrounded, and they had not ever had an action there. And they would very much welcome one, a direct action, meaning that we would actually try to enter the base and in some way symbolically show that this place is illegal and needs to be closed down.
Now, the storage of plutonium was there. Tell listeners what plutonium is.
Well, actually, it's the uranium. Plutonium is a byproduct of the chemical works that's done on uranium in changing it from a low-grade explosive material to a very highly, and we call it highly enriched uranium, which can then be the trigger for setting off a hydrogen bomb, actually.
So to clarify, Megan, the enriched uranium was both manufactured and stored at Oak Ridge?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, it's a fuel storage place, but they're continuing to make it, and they're continuing to make bombs, you know, put it into the form of the actual new bombs. New bombs are being created as we speak right now. It's not been stopped, and yet, internationally, it's all illegal. So this is a highly, highly illegal activity that the United States government is engaged in, and they should be sanctioned by the rest of the world for that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of profiteering going on, because these are huge trillion-dollar appropriations by the United States budget. Your tax dollars, everybody's tax dollars, are being spent on manufacturing weapons of mass destruction, which are totally against international law.
And so you and Greg kind of looked over, you did a reconnaissance of Oak Ridge. Did you have information like maps, that detailed kind of information? And where, if so, where did you get it?
Greg did all of that on the internet. He was able to go into satellite pictures and images and focus down and see exactly what was there. And he did a huge amount of research and did it very well, so that he was our leader in telling us what and when and where we could go in order to enter that base and label it as illegal and expose. That's the whole thing. expose in order to oppose what was going on illegally in that very secret Y-12 facility in the larger nuclear weapons, I guess you call it military base, really, which is Oak Ridge.
So from the imagery that Greg picked up of the whole facility that's known as Y-12 at Oak Ridge, you eventually, physically driving along, were able to find where you were going to make entrance into the security complex.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, sort of a eureka moment? You're driving along, you say, wow, look at that fence. Could we get through there? Or was that more involved than just that?
We were eight people who had spent almost the whole year of 2011-12 meeting to discern about how we would do it, you know, because we had to make the final plans. And in the end, after we had been together for 8 days in the woods, a very secluded place, it turned out that the three of us were free to do it, and we were willing and able. The others had to back out because they had various responsibilities, children, jobs, and whatever. They were not free, they felt, to go to a long prison sentence. And the three of us were willing and able to do that.
Tell us about the actual entry.
There were four of us in a pickup, and one was driving us. We were all part of the eight original ones. And so the three of us and the driver. So we started about 2 a.m. in the darkness. Oh, no, he dropped us off at the base of the ridge of Oak Ridge. And so then the car drove away immediately and was out of everybody's sight so that nobody would be connected with this delivery of us. And they never found who helped us, in other words. So we then had a torch, I guess, two anyway, and the three of us started through the woods. And it was all very thick woods.
When you say torch, you're talking about flashlights.
I meant flashlight, right. So we called it in Nigeria, we call them torches, flashlight. So we just very slowly worked our way through no path or anything, through dense woods. And it took us about an hour and a half, I think, to get to the top. And finally, when we got to the top, we were able to look over and see this valley between the two ridges totally lit up. So we sat there for about 20 minutes and we saw a security car, not many, one. And it turned out to be a white van driving around the road, which is the perimeter road of this whole thing. And it took about 20 minutes for him to come back and repeat the tour that he was making through the night. So we timed it, and then once we knew that it had passed, it wouldn't come back for 20 minutes, so we were able to descend the ridge, and we came to the first fence, which we were able to make a right angle bend by cutting, and then make a flap in the fence and climb through, and then close it up afterwards with little plastic ties, so that it wouldn't look as though it was for another animal or something to get through. And then there were three more fences very close, and we were able to cut through each of those maybe 5 or 10 minutes. So by the next 20 minutes, we were inside the fourth fence and put our things down on the thing, and we had spray paint. We were able to make labels on the building with the spray paint.
You're listening to episode 10 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is Sister Megan Rice. The building, Megan, is the building where the enriched uranium is.
The building, the highly enriched uranium manufacturing place and storage of for the fuel for all the nuclear weapons in the country, of which there are 7,200 or something. Then we did our symbolic act of resistance, pouring blood on the building opening up a fresh loaf of bread to offer to any security that came. And gradually, the security car that had passed on the outside, we saw it driving along the inside between the fourth fence and the wall of this warehouse, you'd call it. No windows, just a big, long, 300 feet or something in length, painted white. And we had decorated it with these statements. And then so we had the bread in our hands. We had two candles to symbolize the light of truth that we were bringing into this place, exposing it and opposing it. And so we stood as like two altar boys and a priest holding the bread to offer the bread to the first security person, the same one. So this same security van drove inside the fourth fence and very slowly drove toward us. And we were standing waiting for him, and he stopped the van, and we heard him say, "They are peacemakers. You better send more people." So he was talking on his phone, and then we brought the bread over to him, and we said, "We were very happy to offer you some bread. Would you take it or something?" And he didn't. But I said, "Well, we said, that can we read our statement to you why we are here?" And he never said yes or no. So we started reading the statement, and it was one page long. And so we got right down to the end of it before another van slowly came up. And in the second van, they had two people with guns. This man had no gun when he was alone. And so we put down everything on the ground in front of us, and they told us to lie down. And then we lay down on the ground, and for a while we were facing down. And then after a while, they brought a stool, many hours, several hours, they brought a chair. So we were able to stand up and sit on chairs, the three of us, while they waited and for directions for what would be happening to us. And that didn't take place until close to 11 o'clock that morning. We had been there since 2 in the morning.
You were then taken in for booking of some kind. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we were put in one car, the three of us in the back seat of one car, and we were able to talk, and we talked to the drivers and everything, and they drove us to sort of a headquarters area. I think it was actually a different town, Knoxville. I think they drove us to Knoxville, where the jail is, and we were taken out and processed and put in jail for six nights, actually. And we had to go to court three times during that week.
Okay, so what happens next? There's a process of you had to get lawyers. Did you get some legal assistance, and how did that come about?
Oh, yeah. There's always the same people step forward. It's always our dear Bill Quigley in charge. You know, he's professor of law at in New Orleans. But he always appears, you know, and ready to defend us and to help us that way. And his assistant, wonderful woman, Anna Lelid, also very much supporting us. So we were sent to a town on the border between Georgia and Florida, of Ocilla. And that was a county jail. And we were there for many months, actually, awaiting the trial. And then the trial was starting in January, February. They kept postponing it, 2013. And then we had our trial in May.
Could you tell us a bit about that trial in May of 2013? What did you plea, in other words? Did you plea not guilty?
Oh, yes, of course. We were there to expose and oppose the illegality of this base. And that was each of us made a clear statement about that. And we had a wonderful women who were, well, that was later at the actual, when the court trial was taking place, like Anne Wright and a number of people from who had long experience in nuclear resistance.
To testify in your behalf, right?
Testified, witnessed, yeah, to our character.
That would be Colonel Ann Wright, the diplomat who left her diplomatic leadership in Kabul, Afghanistan, when the United States had the invasion, shock and awe, of Iraq in 2003. Okay, but now this is 2010 years later, 2013, and Ann Wright, Colonel Ann Wright, yeah.
And Ann had actually also been involved in moving and storing nuclear weapons as a colonel. That had been her role. So she was very, very much aware and had dissociated herself from the Army, retired, because she recognized that this was all illegal. So she wanted to express the international law aspect of using nuclear weapons or having them.
Of course, first the prosecution had their chance to bring out their particular team to show that you were guilty of this serious crime, in their view?
Yeah, the prosecutors. I really don't remember anything much from what they were saying, because it was very much exaggerated and also not naming the real crime.
Well, in order to make it a felony, they eventually, I believe, that they say that it was sabotage, and you were convicted under the Sabotage Act?
Oh, yes. And they also kind of bartered with us if we were willing to negotiate and avoid a trial. And then they said, since we would not do that, we wanted a trial, then they upped the crime to sabotage. Yeah.
And what happens? You're convicted of sabotage?
And destruction of government property, those two.
Now, the destruction was cutting through those four fences and then painting.
That's right. On the wall.
Did they put a dollar figure on that, by the way?
Oh, yes. 52,993, with all sorts of very exaggerated charges, like 100 gallons of paint. 100 gallons of paint. Greg, who's a painter, said all they needed was one.
There was a cost involved, which was financial, but the major cost was what the prison sentence that it was given to you. What were the sentences that were?
Michael and Greg, because they had done previous plowshares actions, got 5 years, and I got 3 years, close to 35 months. And immediately when we were sentenced, somebody in the court said, "We will appeal this." We didn't know anything about this, and my relative of mine knew her brother, who was a member of a big corporate law firm in New York, that they would take it on if she asked them to. So they set aside 5 young lawyers to do nothing but research this case of sabotage. And at the end of a year, they had their 100 pages of their statement, and it won. So we were then released instantaneously after 25 months.
Where did you spend your time with that incarceration, Megan?
I was sent first to Osceola, and then from Osceola to Brooklyn, New York, because I was considered a New Yorker. My comrades, one was sent to Kansas City, and Michael was sent to some place between New York State and Pennsylvania, in Pennsylvania, but close to New York State, because he was from Dorothy Day in Baltimore. Oh, no, where was he? In New York, Dorothy Day, Catholic worker. And so there was no room for women in any of the prisons. The men had taken over Danbury. So I was just sent awaiting to go to prison in Brooklyn, which was on the 6th floor of an 8-story jail for men, built for 3,000 men. But there was one floor turned over to 120 women on the 6th floor, I think it was. So I joined 100 women who were incarcerated because there was no other prison for women to go to. It was just a holding place, a dormitory. And so we were there for 11 months. I was there for 11 months.
You've done a lot of prison ministry over the years. Could you relate just one case that you met in Manhattan?
Michelle West is the person who was informed upon and given this sentence, two life sentences plus 50 years, and charged with having associated in a drug-related murder. And they never explained what the association was, but the man who did the murder was informed in the courts or to the government that she was the one who did the murder. Yes, in other words, he lied. And because he exposed her, and I think there was another circle in this group that were sort of involved in a drug ring. So she was serving the 27th year of her two life sentences plus 50-year charge. And she's the most gentle, mild, kind woman. So we are actually trying very hard to get her her sentence commuted or compassionate, whatever, you know, because she's been such an exemplary, absolutely exemplary prisoner in all those years, and has helped so many others. You know, she becomes the counselor to all the women who are so troubled.
Sister Megan Rice, what do you really think has to be changed in the American educational system to make students more enthusiastic about ending this horror of nuclear weaponry?
Well, I think the first step is to get started with teaching it in the elementary school level. It can be whenever we hit World War II, we have to explain to our students what was used and how dreadful that bomb is. It's a bomb that destroys all life as we know it. And it will destroy the planet if we ever use the bomb again. Only three bombs have been used. But if ever we use it again, the planet will be destroyed because it's 1,000 times as powerful as the first atom bombs that were used in 1945 on Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
You've been listening to episode 10 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest has been Sister Megan Rice. You can find this episode in the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.